Do you invest in ETFs? Whether you're thinking, what in the world is an ETF? Or you're looking for the next opportunity to add to your portfolio. GlobalX has you covered. From big tech to bonds and bars of gold, GlobalX offers a wide range of exchange-traded funds. Go beyond ordinary with GlobalX ETFs. Visit globalxetfs.com.au. That's globalxetfs.com.au.
InvestSmart's portfolios are turning 10. And to celebrate, 10 InvestSmart boot camps are up for grabs. This self-paced online course is ideal for both seasoned investors and those who are just starting out. Valued at $99, you could win a spot on this highly rated course. To enter the competition and for terms and conditions, simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Don't miss out on this chance to learn from experts and take your investing to the next level. Simply visit investsmart.com.au/win. Good luck.
Hey there, here's a quick note. This podcast contains general financial advice only. That means it's not specific to you, your needs, goals, or objectives, so don't act on the information until you've spoken with your financial advisor. You'll find our full disclosure, disclaimer, and link to our financial services guide in the show notes.
Drew Meredith, how you going?
Pretty good. Good to be here as always.
Good to be here. Nice and early for you as well. I think you're still on Perth time.
Yeah, so definitely. What does that make
early
it?
Or late?
10 a.m.?
Yeah.
It seemed like a good idea when I thought of it, but yeah.
So maybe it was very difficult. Fill people in. We've already got some people joining us live for the show. Good evening, good day, wherever you are joining us from. Say hello. What have you been up to? Like, why would I be referencing Perth? Hey, Benny.
I just went over to Waddle has clients in basically every capital city, so I went over to meet a few existing and new clients over there. Some lovely people, but for some reason, I mean, probably cost saving, I decided it was a good idea to fly to Perth in the morning and return from Perth on Thursday night, same day. So it's about 8 hours of travel. I think I said I was up for 17 hours, worked on the plane for 8, and had meeting for 6. Rest I was in an Uber.
For anyone that's done that flight, like from Perth to East Coast and back again, or East Coast to Perth and back again, that is such a long trip.
It's probably the best way to do it. It was only 3 hours 10 on the way back. Like, that's the fastest I've ever seen on the way back. There's something to do with the weather patterns at the moment is just giving that tailwind.
Hey, Marco. Good to see you here. Go the Blues.
I met
win for the Blues for Carlton this week, just so you know. Anyway, go for it, Drew.
I was saying, we've met some lovely people that reached out via the podcast too, so it was great.
Yeah, cool. Yeah. Keep reaching out, guys. Like, keep saying good day. We love your feedback. Last week was easily the most questions we've ever received for the Australian Investors Podcast 2 cents on a Saturday morning. Obviously, we're recording this on a Friday, for those of you that are joining live.
I think we spent 40 minutes not answering them.
Yeah, but we love them. We actually did. Last week, we actually got feedback, which was in the show, which was probably the fun bit. So keep it coming. We've got heaps this week. But this week is easily the biggest and best week for kind feedback, responses, praise for the show. So that's 2 records as far as I'm concerned. And
about time, I think, too.
Yeah, I know. I say heckle, and then everyone comes in, hey, Mike, good to see you, mate. I say heckle 1 week and then everyone sends in praise. So maybe if we ask for praise this week, everyone will heckle next week. But yeah, we've got some great questions today. We've obviously got a few big headlines. Drew's going to do a big reveal for those of you that have already read the headline before you clicked on the video or the podcast. Drew, in the headline, you did say a $283,000 tax saving. Talk to us about this.
So as someone who listened to the podcast last week, there was a question that said, is financial advice worth it? And we were just catching up with him and his wife literally before I walked in here, and our team. So Fatuma, who I think has been on here as well, Annette and the rest of the team had put together a statement of advice, financial plan. And one of the biggest outcomes was that the family would save over $280,000 in tax in the next 10 years.
Wow.
Just in tax. That was literally just a tax saving, not any other investment benefit or other, even any other consideration.
Wait, so this was the the same person who asked the question last week. Like, you don't have to give away their name, but like,
No, they didn't ask the question. That just happened. They listened and they happened to hear that question. And then when they heard what the, you know, that was just the individual tax benefit. That was just from the recommendations that we made to change their situation compared to if they did nothing. So it was, it's if you're trying to, as we were trying to explain last week, there's quantifiable value in advice. That's quantifiable. And there's unquantifiable, which is more of the personal and the, and not necessarily emotional support, but the, you know, the guidance during periods of stress.
Yeah. Yeah. Wow. Well, because I've seen this in action. A lot of people don't think about like a statement of advice, which is a financial plan. A lot of people think that they pay thousands of dollars for this document and they think, well, what am I actually going to get? And then at the end of the 12-month period, you're like, hold on a second. The return is, say, I don't know, for my portfolio is 9%. I could have got 8% in my old super fund or old strategy, but that misses like everything else. But also the change that you make today is positive change for probably decades to come.
And the compounding that comes out of it. And it could be like that's just tax savings because tax was important, but there's cost savings that weren't mentioned, then investment, and then, you know, there's time savings that come along with that as well.
Mm. I like it. I like it. And you had a really good answer to that. Is an advisor worth it last week? I've been contending with some of my own questions and problems this week. Someone asked me.
Are you a camper?
Someone asked me. So someone said to me, are you into camping? Because you look like a person that would enjoy camping. And I was thinking to myself, what does a person that looks like they would enjoy camping seem like? And am I one of those people?
They wear zip up. Jumpers?
Yeah. Zip-up jumpers just coming out of summer. But I don't know. What does a camping person look like? We've actually got a question on a company called Campify, I believe, that came through from Fashion Phil.
I assume you'd have a beard.
Mm. Yeah,
you look probably good in a hat. You're kind of handy. I mean, you do post a lot about fishing. So naturally, I think if you're a lot of fishing requires camping. So I think it's a natural assumption that if you fish, you might like camping.
Mm. Yeah, it's just interesting. Like, I just love those thought-provoking questions that we get given from time to time. And that was one of those ones. So thank you, Zara, for sharing that with us. But for what it's worth, mate, you would also, maybe I wouldn't say you're a camping person, but you look like the type of guy that would enjoy camping.
Really? I've actually never been interested in camping, but now I really want to camp.
No,
proper camp. Get a swag.
Yeah. Actually, yeah, I can understand where you might be more
get the kids out of the mud.
Yeah. CBA shares going to $10, says analyst. But seriously, CBA shares have hit a 35-year high at a time when everyone says property prices are going to crash because interest rates are skyrocketing. Thoughts, Drew?
Diversify.
What do you
As
mean?
Always. No, so this came from an article in the Fin over the weekend. One of the big analysts, who does it, I think it looks like Goldman Sachs, brought it up. Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily their share price hit a 35-year high, but the PE ratio that they're trading on has gone up to around six. That he said about 16.2 times. Maybe it is a 35-year. I mean, it doesn't go back there. But it's more the multiple that's driving it. And what he pointed out was, you know, we talk a lot about what's happened in the tech sector and how Nvidia, Microsoft, all these companies have been dominating the Mag 7 have been dominating the S&P 500 returns. Well, it's been the opposite here, where the banking sector, which he said the PE ratio surged 23% in the since late last year, the banking sector has driven the ASX to an all-time high or over close to an all-time high, about 7,800 points. So it's not the same story happening everywhere. And I think that's what the message is. But like so you're saying the PE ratio has increased 23%. That means the multiple, earnings haven't increased that much. Maybe they've increased 5%. The multiple has increased significantly of what people are willing to pay for the bank, for CBA, and for banks in general.
Mm. For those of you that
anyone expected that.
For those of you that are watching, I'll just quickly bring up a bit of a screen on CBA's financials just via the ticket terminal. Shout out to the ticket terminal, no relationship, but awesome platform. So one of the things that I always find a bit frustrating, Drew, I don't know about you, and I was going to ask this question not knowing that we were going to talk about CBA today. I actually had it in the document and then that we work from, but then I was like, oh, you know what? Let's talk about something like camping. But One of the things that always frustrates me is most people still use PE ratios as like the number one valuation tool for a bank. And for me, it's always been the price to book ratio.
Which is a good global indicator.
Yeah, it compares assets to it compares the assets against the share price, not their earnings or the profit. And the reason is that some of the banks use a lot of leverage, like 16 to 1 in terms of the amount of equity. Every bank has to use leverage. Australian banks are quite leveraged by a global standard. So if we go
like $8 in capital for every $100 in loan or thereabouts.
Yeah, yeah. So you can see that here. You can see here the price to earnings ratio on diluted earnings per share last 12 months is up around 20 times. This is according to the ticket terminal. It depends on when you get your data and all that sort of jazz.
Yeah.
After COVID, it spiked to about 26 times price earnings ratio. But now let's have a look for those of you that are playing along at home. We'll bring up the price to book ratio. I'll turn off the PE. And here we can see, if we go a bit longer, we can see that it's actually below the peak price to book ratio in 2015. So it kind of tells a different story.
And I feel like the normal price to book around the world, Australia is a bit different, but it's like 1.5 to 1.6. And I can't see, that's way too small for me. But generally, anything over 2 is seen as like globally expensive. Yep. I think, what was that, 2.5?
Yeah, 2.5, 2.6.
And that's CBA. But part of, if you looked at NAB, I reckon NAB would be below 2.
Yeah, 1.6.
Yeah. So that's just showing the franchise and the name and the, as we know, the deposit funding that runs CBA means they're not, you know, relying on capital markets to raise capital all the time.
Yeah. That's a really good point you bring up. So just to click on that.
It'd be the same for all those four banks. CBA would have the highest price to book, and not that it deserves 2.6, but it deserves to have a higher one.
It always has deserved it, to be honest. But one of the things to keep in mind here is that you make a really good point about deposit funding. So for those of you that don't know, basically a bank brings in money and then it lends it out. But where it gets the money from is really important. CBA gets the majority of its money from term deposits, which is not always the case. Like typically there's a lot of deposit funding, but it can be from what we call wholesale debt markets. It's where they go overseas, get loans, get bonds, that type of stuff, issue bonds. But that tends to be a bit higher priced, that type of funding versus a term deposit. And everyone will know this because you will see your mortgage interest rate go up before your term deposits go up. And you always pay more on your mortgage versus your term deposit that you receive. So that's basically a sign that the banks are able to get funding and issue loans at compelling rates. And you're probably wondering, well, okay, then how do you join those two dots together? The single most important metric for a bank's profitability is something called the net interest margin. And that's basically the difference between the term deposit rate and the mortgage rate, in effect. And there's a lot of other math around it.
Yeah.
But that's basically it. It's like, how much does it cost for them to get money in versus money out? And, you know, CBA has always historically had a pretty good net interest margin, whereas the other banks tend to bounce around a bit, particularly the regional banks, because they have higher funding costs. So that's just a little bit of education on CBA shares. I don't own any shares unless it's through an ETF. But other one that's doing really well, Drew, is, of course, Macquarie Group, probably the two best banks in the country. Maybe the podium goes third to NAB. But definitely Macquarie, investment bank / retail bank more often, also shooting the lights out.
Yeah, it was a bit of a surprise too, I think, that the banks have done so well over the last 3 months, because the last reports last year were showing net interest margin had reduced in the second half. Everyone was worrying more about recession, and now it's turned incredibly quickly and everyone's, you know, back heavily into it again. So Macquarie always at the moment has difficult comparables. So Macquarie has their banking and financial services. Their bank is actually, I think it's less than 20% of the company. They have capital markets, so IPOs, capital raisings. Then they have asset management, and asset management's where they probably profits fallen off, because to make money in asset management, you have to be selling your assets in where they work. So green energy is something where they do a lot of funding. So their earnings have probably been more static, but the share price has recovered. And that's what we're talking about when we say PE multiples have gone up, that people are more willing to pay more for the same dollar of earnings than before, versus the earnings going off and then becoming cheaper. So it's been a great few months for the banks.
And it's It's if you took this exact moment, say 2 years ago or a year ago, and you said, well, in a couple of years, CBA is going to be flying, Macquarie is going to be flying, NAB is going to be flying, everyone would be, what? I just read in that insert name of really popular newspaper that prices are falling 26%.
Just block the noise. Like it's so much block, like all of last year. I think there were so many things that CBA would never get back to $100. It's at 115. Mm. Like it's always easy to get caught into that. You know, the short-term negativity, one piece of bad news becomes everything. But it's why, you know, four banks isn't diversified, but having a whole heap of different companies in your portfolio. So when the banks aren't doing well, something else is doing well, I think is key. And now the banks are doing well, so other areas aren't.
I remember when I started writing publicly about the banks and saying, oh, they're probably a bit overvalued. That was 2013.
CBA was 60 bucks.
It's probably paid that in dividends. Diversify. Anyway, yeah, I mean, it's a wonderful business. And just like BHP and CSL, if you own an ETF that tracks the top companies, you've got exposure to these businesses anyway. So that's wonderful. So don't, I guess, fret that if you don't own the individual stock, your super fund, or you probably do through a fund or something like that. Joe, welcome back, mate. Good to see you in the chat. I wanted to ask, do you feel going for dividend stocks and franking credits is more effective in an SMSF? So I guess the question there, Drew, is, yeah, inside an SMSF, self-managed super fund, super has a lower tax rate environment. Does it make sense to focus more on income, or is it kind of doesn't really matter? What do you think?
I think, it always depends. I think superannuation being a 15% tax rate, you're going to get the benefit. If you're in pension phase, naturally you're basically getting 1.5% free kick for investing in frank and receiving fully frank dividends. And that's kind of fairly well proven. That doesn't mean you can rely on just dividend paying companies and frank credit paying companies, because in Australia most of those companies aren't growing, so earnings aren't growing, they're multiple shift all the time. So I think naturally there's a benefit for as long as you can get a refund on excess frank credits when you have no tax payable, it's always going to be attractive. And when you can't, as long as you've got tax that you can use to offset those frank credits, because that does apply in your personal name as well.
Good question, Joe. We do get a lot of people think that, and it's reasonable to think that given that you are using super as a vehicle for long-term compounding or in retirement. So it does make sense to then focus on income producing franking credits, all that sort of stuff. To be honest, you know what, Drew, it's probably the number one conversation I'm having lately with people over 50 is a lot of people cycling out of property and into, like, they're seeking dividend paying strategies, whether that's in an SMSF, a family trust, a insert whatever vehicle. They are looking to cycle out of property. I think it's because of the funding costs, the land taxes, all that sort of stuff, massive equity buildup. So they're trying now to find passive income streams. And so a lot of people would be asking that same question. So thanks for that.
So we're going to work on that. I think we're going to work on that retirement series again.
Yes. Good shout out. Yes. A bit of promo. So we are going to be doing
a retirement as well.
It's a man of many preps. So we do have the retirement series coming up on the Australian Investors Podcast in a couple of months. So keep an eye and ear, whether you're watching on YouTube or you do absorb the podcast in your Apple CarPlay device or wherever you are. Please keep an eye out for the retirement series, which is coming up soon on the Australian Investors Podcast. Just got a message from Queenie Tan. Go on.
We talk a lot about concentration at the moment, that the ASX is so concentrated and the S&P, the Magnificent Seven. Which country, developed country, do you think has the most concentration in the top 10? I've actually got this in the notes, so don't go find it.
Drew, by the way, Drew puts about 50,000 pages of notes in, so I don't have a chance to review it anyway.
I drop it right before we go live.
So the stock, the market, the country with the stock exchange that has the most concentration in the top 10.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. I think the US is like 45% or something.
Yeah, but the Magnificent Seven got, yeah. Okay, I would say, I would maybe say India.
No.
What is it?
It's actually a tie. So okay. Germany and France both have 57% in their top 10 stocks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Where is it? Do you have any examples of names that would be in there?
22% of the German index is in SAP, which is the, you know, soft, you know, the Enterprise Software and Siemens.
Yep.
And in France, Louis Vuitton and Total. So Total Energies and Louis Vuitton, Moët Hennessy.
Wow.
They're 20%. So we, you know, we talk a lot about concentration risk, and but it's, and whether it's good or bad, I think there's a case for both, but we're not actually any worse than anywhere else in the world. We're not that unique, is what I'm trying to say. But if you go around.
Isn't that funny though, Drew? Like when you think about, like, so let's go to the Australia, France, Germany. And what's Germany known for? Like software, technology, automation, you know.
There you go.
And then you've got France, which is oil and beauty.
Luxury. I didn't think oil would be there. I thought it'd be something else, pharma.
Yeah, and then Australia is just banking. Always a bit of mining in there, let's be honest.
Banking and mining. I mean, China's only 42%. Canada's 45%. And the UK is 50 as well.
So it's pretty common then that markets are top
heavy. Incredibly common in those benchmarks. That's all off the iShares benchmarks from what I could Google.
Okay. If you do have any questions and you do want to send them through, please drop them now in the YouTube chat. If you're watching on Twitter, LinkedIn, or wherever you're watching, please head over to the RAS YouTube channel. That's the best place to leave your questions so we can see them live. Otherwise, you can use the Ask a Question link that's available every weekend or every episode in any of the RASC podcasts. Select the Australian Investors podcast. Obviously, we don't know your personal circumstances, your needs, goals, or objectives, so please seek the advice of a licensed and trusted financial professional, like, say, Drew here, or any financial planner who you can look up on the Money Smart website. Make sure they've got an AFSL, that's an Australian Financial Services license. And of course, if we do answer questions, we do ask for funny names, just as an extra added element that we just don't know who you are. And so we cannot give you personalized financial advice. We will stick to general information only. And if we do mention things like ETFs or super funds, there is something called a product disclosure statement, a PDS. That's a really good document and should read that before you invest or do anything. Okay, so there were a few other talking points, Drew, but maybe we can jump down into some of the feedback that we've got. There was chicken toasty, coffee roasty, which is a definite piece of play on words to something we've been mentioning probably in the last two or three episodes, which is there's a wonderful chicken jalapeno toasty at a Victorian or Melbourne-based cafe called Vacation. Shout out to Vacation. And that's where this one comes from. Hi, Investor Dream Team. My question, can you explain, is it better to buy government bonds or bond ETFs when global interest rates are high, i.e. now? And if so, why? Sorry if this is a silly question. It's not a silly question. This is a fantastic question, actually. So, Drew, when interest rates are high...
I thought this was feedback.
Does it make sense? This is feedback, but does it make sense? I thought this was a good educational point. The next one
is probably more feedback.
There's good feedback.
And there's the big part here is there's this question and discussion about diversification. So why would you ever hold government bonds or bonds in general? That's because you're looking to diversify the risk in the other investments you own. That could be property, that could be shares. And why do we do that? Because bonds should act differently to shares in different circumstances. Why is this such a long answer to a seemingly simple question? Because when interest rates were at zero, bonds offered significantly less diversification benefits because the return you're getting from those bonds and the ability for those bonds to move in value was significantly limited. So what's happened now that interest rates, you can get about a 4.5% return by investing in government bonds via an ETF, is that you're now getting rewarded for locking your money away or for investing. You don't lock your money away in an ETF, but the bonds are 5 to 15-year bonds. And now you're getting diversification benefit back again in the fact that the consensus now is that interest rates are at or near the highest they will be for this period, however long that is. No one actually knows, so there's never any certainty around this. But there is now potential for interest rates to be cut if something goes wrong, if we see a recession, if we see difficulty in different parts of the economy. And what happens when interest rates are cut is that the bonds that you own at the moment increase in value because the income you're receiving on those will be higher than the income you could get by investing in the new round of bonds being issued. I thought that was going to be a simple answer, but it became much more complicated than I thought.
Well, it's very well-rounded. You started off very strong.
The idea here is that if we have really real difficulty in the economy, then share markets would be expected to fall. So your share portion of your portfolio would struggle. You know, anytime there's an economic correction or bad news, they can fall 5 to 10%. In that case, banks generally respond by cutting interest rates, which means the bond portion of your portfolio would perform well when the share portion of your portfolio isn't.
Mm-hmm. Perfect.
Long way. And, we're running out of time here.
No, I love it. And just so to explain why bonds tend to go up in value is that if you have a bond that was issued today and it was paying 1% per year, remember that a bond only returns the original value. So like $100 will be returned in year 10, for example. It's not like a share, which can just grow into infinity. It wouldn't happen, but that's in theory what could happen. With a bond, you're guaranteed to get your $100 back. So the only thing that changes really is the coupon payments, which are like dividends in between, and they're set by the current interest rates. So in effect, if they had a bond that was issued today at 5%, and then you could buy this bond today for $100 and know that you're going to get $100 back in the future, but you will also get $5 a year, you know, for the next 10 years. If tomorrow interest rates drop to 1%, you still get your $100 back, but the bond that's issued tomorrow with a 1% yield is worth less than the one that was issued today because it's not offering as much as a return. So in effect, your bond today is worth more than the one tomorrow. So that's why they go up. But it's a good question. So it's a really good question. We do have, there was a bit of praise. Maybe I'll jump to some praise real quick, Drew. This comes from Humongous.
That answer.
Humongous Gains writes in and says, "Dear Owen and Drew, I'm wanting to express my sincere gratitude for the Australian Investors Podcast, your dedication to providing genuine advice and cutting through the noise of bad financial information is truly invaluable. As an Australian investor, I find your insights on the local market particularly helpful. I'm incredibly excited about Drew's upcoming book, Golden Years." Oh, there you go, Drew. What's the book called?
The Golden Years.
Okay. "And can't wait to delve into the wisdom on navigating the investment landscape in this next phase. My questions are as follows. Beyond the traditional asset classes, are there any alternative investments that you see gaining traction in the coming golden years? And the second one is, does a DRP simplify things during tax season or make them worse?" I'll go quickly with that one. A DRP is simple if you're accumulating, but there are tax consequences that do come into it. So you still need to record it as income. That should all be captured if you use ShareSite, Nevexa, if you use a portfolio tool like a financial advisor would use, like NetWealth or something like that. It can all track that. So you still need to pay tax on a DRP. Dividend reinvestment plan. So, but Drew, the first question was, like, are there any alternative investments that you see gaining traction in the coming golden years?
I think this is a topic we've talked about a lot, and they're gaining traction generally, but still not to the level that, you know, some industry funds and institutional investors are. And that's like alternative investments like private equity and private markets. We know, we probably bring up the stat all the time. I think something like 2% of all companies in the world are on the ASX or the S&P and are on available on share markets. So 98% of companies, which means all kinds of sectors, niche areas aren't actually available on share markets. So I think private equity, and this is something we're working a lot with clients, is educating them around why private markets are valuable. In some cases, you have to give up the ability to sell them and access your money for a year or two or quarters, whatever it happens to be. So I think private equity definitely. And why? It's like we talked about bonds before. Because the way private equity performs and reacts to different market environments is very different to the way shares perform. Because they're private, they're not traded every day, so you have less price volatility, and that allows you to be more patient in letting those businesses grow and compound. So, and I think alternatives are an important part of any retiree's portfolio or any you know golden years portfolio because they're more stable and hopefully they help in we find. During periods of volatility, when there's things that are staying still, you know, people get more comfort, and or whether they're not falling as much as you know, the CBA could fall 30% as it did a few years ago. So it helps to make more less emotional decisions.
Yep, I like it. Good answer. There have been quite a few questions that have come in. Mike says, "Can you explain how personal indexing works?" I think
maybe what you're suggesting, Mike, is a direct indexing. I could be mistaken. But the idea of direct indexing is that currently with an index fund, you kind of just get the ASX 300 or you get the S&P 500 or the NASDAQ 100. If direct indexing becomes really popular in Australia, as it has done in the United States, you will be able to customize that index. So effectively, you log into your platform and you say, I like the ASX 200, but I don't want any iron ore and I don't want any supermarkets. And then it just does a calculation in the background and it basically creates a portfolio for you and you can click buy on that basket. That's basically what it is. So I hope that makes sense. It would probably be a custodial model, meaning, Mike, that you wouldn't be able to own each of the individual. Oh, okay. So, I see what Mike's actually not referring to.
Transfer balance cap.
Yeah.
So I reckon the easiest way to explain this would be to give a link to the ATO site because it is quite detailed. Yeah. So he's referring to the transfer balance cap rather than there's two caps that apply in superannuation. There's a total superannuation balance, which is, I think it's about to increase to 1.9 million per person. Yes, and there's a transfer balance cap, which is how much you can have in tax-free pension phase, in which case you don't pay any tax on the earnings and all the income is generally tax-free if you're over 60. It is quite complicated though, because that cap started at 1.6 million and is now up to 1.9, depending on how much of that cap you used at different points is how much you have in the new cap. So it's a little bit beyond this, I think, podcast, if you saw me explain bonds before. but we'll put a link, I think the best way is put a link in the show notes to this. There's a very good on the ATO website with case studies. And that would definitely, that'd be something that you need to talk to an advisor or accountant about as well.
Yeah, definitely, Mike. There is a lot
I'd
of
love
there,
to answer it. But,
there is a lot of information on the ATO website. Drew, for anyone watching, you're going to have to keep them entertained because I'm going to grab a book off the shelf and direct Mike to something. Okay. The next question. Okay. Not yet. Not dad joke yet. Okay. The person who sends this question in is known as I Got a Mungering for the $2.99 All You Can Eat Buffett, who says, is it worth selling individual companies if you think they have reached your limit and then put the profits into super as an after-tax contribution so you can claim them off tax at the end of the year? Well, it's basically about recycling your profits into super. Over to you, Drew. I'm going to grab that book.
There's, of course, at least he's online this time. Last time it all shut down, I had to talk to myself for 10 minutes. I think there's two questions. I think there are two questions. Don't confuse the two. So you're on one side, you're talking about, do I sell an individual company when it hits my value? That's up to your approach and make sure you have a framework. But you know, generally, you're either taking profits on the way or rebalancing as we would. And the other question is, should I make an as an after-tax contribution, so you can claim the after. Technically, that would be a concessional contribution you're talking about, and a concessional contribution is considered a pre-tax rather than after-tax contribution. It does attract contributions tax when you make the contribution in the fund or at the end of the year, but you do get a dollar-for-dollar tax deduction for the amount that you're contributing. So I think there's different conversations. Yes, rebalance as appropriate, depending on your philosophy. And two, one thing we do as advisors and part of our ongoing process is in every May, we look at the tax position of every client, capital gains, income, anything else, and make an assessment as to whether they can use their concessional caps to take some more deductions. So your cap's increasing to 30,000 from 1 July and it's 27,500 at the moment.
Yeah, I'd say for younger folks.
Really long at answering, so.
No, that's all right. It must be that Perth air that was very fresh. All the really stuffy COVID air that you get when you fly on a plane these days. So this book here, Mike, for anyone that's watching, is the Master Financial Planning Guide. It's one of the most comprehensive books on financial planning and everything.
Similar to this one. Your Bible, my Bible.
This book is something that I refer to a lot. Mike, and I'm not saying that you go and read it, but even when we get dealt with difficult questions as financial professionals, it's always good to have resources like this on hand. So if you are interested in doing that, but the ATO website is probably the best thing for the indexing because it is updated regularly and it does help you through examples and that sort of stuff. Yes, bugger me, Owen. Yeah, Mike, I don't expect you to read this one, but it is a quite good book. Got me through uni, I'll tell you that much. Okay, so We do have a lot of good questions sent in. I think just with that question from the $2.99 or you can eat Buffett. Thanks, Benny, for that one. On that, I think for younger people in particular, so if I answer this from an accumulator's perspective, I think if you're younger, I think it makes sense to keep more money outside of super if you are long-term compounding and if you believe that you are, there is a chance that you may retire early. And one of the best things that people can do is be a long-term investor, because even if you do sell for a profit, if you hold the investment for more than 12 months, you're going to get a capital gains tax discount. So hypothetically, if you made a $100 gain ordinarily as a short-term gain, you're only going to pay tax on $50 if you hold it for more than the required time. And that's really important, because even if you're on the higher tax rate, you're only paying tax on half of it. So in effect, your effective tax rate is actually quite good. So I wouldn't be too hung up on trying necessarily to find these other strategies to offset it. Personally, what I think is the way I go about it is that I like to just make sure I'm a long-term investor, make sure I'm reporting my tax correctly over the 12-month limit. Okay, there are a lot of good questions sent in advance. I might jump to one of those. Okay, here we go. This is a good question. Aspirational Retire Early sent in a question, Drew, and they say, I've been listening to your podcast for around 12 months and I'm thankful for the discussions. Well, you're very welcome. Professional guests and the content you are making available. Well, thank you for that, Aspirational. You often discuss ETFs and the benefits of investing in that vehicle rather than individual stocks. Are there downsides that you can discuss on the use of ETFs and how to identify and evaluate them? Absolutely. Just a bit of context here. We do have a free ETF course on the RASK Education website. It is easily our most popular course of all time, and it is 100% free, so go and check that out. But Drew, you and the team at Wattle Partners, you have ETFs, you also have managed funds, but you also have direct stocks in your clients' portfolios. Can you talk through what you see as some of the reasons why you don't just have all ETFs?
Each to their own, and you kind of build portfolios based on your own risk tolerance or what you're comfortable and what you're experienced with. I think, not that it's a drawback of ETFs, but ETFs by their nature just track an index. And if you want to answer this, I'm going to try and do the opposite and answer this as simply as possible. Just having the index isn't always enough. So like what we were talking about before, is that, can I stop it there? Should I stop?
It's like, here's part two.
Yeah. Having, you know, having 57% of your, you know, allocation to the French index or the German index, or, you know, 35% to the US index, only being in 10 stocks. That is not, I'm not comfortable with that for 100% of my allocation to global shares. I want some exposure to Asia, and I want some to smaller companies because I think they'll provide diversification. That's where the limitation of ETFs are, is that they're generally index tracking and they're quite narrow, particularly the way we talk about ETFs on here.
Yeah.
And you're guaranteeing the average return. Not, there's no guaranteed return, but you're guaranteeing the average return, which means if the market does negative 10, you get negative 10. If it does positive 10, you get positive 10. If it does negative 40, you get negative 40. So it's, for us, it's how do you, with our kind of fiduciary hat on, I hate saying that, as a retiree, how do you smooth the ride and make sure that the negative 20 is maybe, oh, the negative 20 is, you know, not negative 20, is far less than that. And how do you make sure the other side is more consistent? Well, it's by blending, in our view, both active and ETF or passive management in portfolios.
I think that's the thing. I don't think you need to have one or the other. I think it's a false choice that we've been given as a investment society. It's like, you're either active or passive. Why not just do both? It's really simple. It's as simple as that. As an individual investor, just do both.
That's in our SOA. So in our statement of advice, one of the first things we say is active and passive. It's value and growth. And it's cyclical and not tech, but basically it's structural. Always and. It doesn't have to be or.
Yeah. There are two things around ETFs. One is, Drew mentioned the liquidity, and there's some things that ETFs just simply cannot apply to. So private investing, which was the question from before, even though there are some ETFs that offer private equity exposure, what they're doing is they're not buying the actual private companies or the private infrastructure. They're just buying the companies that buy the infrastructure. So it's a bit of a, it's actually just a share ETF, but anyway. So there's some things where ETFs simply cannot do the thing that you want, which is fine. The other thing is something that there are a few others, and Drew mentioned the behavioral element, but there's one Other thing here, which ETFs, people should be aware of, that I don't think enough people are talking about. I think we will in the future, which is that a lot of people that buy into diversified ETFs or ETFs that are really good ETFs, they probably are not thinking 10, 20, or 30 years into the future, even though that's probably their goal. And let me give you an example of this. We recently had Balaji Gopal on the show last year. He's from Vanguard. He's a wonderful, wonderful human being, but also a great investor and thinker. And he talked about the Vanguard diversified ETFs, and you can go back to those. And basically what happens is an ETF of other funds. One of the things that happens with an ETF is sometimes you may want to change strategy. So let's say, for example, you have one of the diversified ETFs and it's wonderful, but in 20 years, you've got $1 million in it and you need to all of a sudden start changing your strategy. It's not easy just to pull it apart. So, and then break it up into bits and pieces. Sometimes you want more flexibility. So there's a, I would just encourage anyone that starts building an ETF portfolio with a 10 or 20 year view, as a lot of the RAS community do, just think, does this offer the flexibility that I need? Like, do I need more positions? Do I need more alternatives? Have a look at that and think about that carefully. Like, you can go and buy one of those ETFs. They're wonderful, by the way, but you probably want more flexibility when the time comes to crystallizing tax.
Tax, it's a feed through into you. So the structure of ETFs in the US is different to the structure of ETFs in Australia. In Australia, basically any gains or profit has to be distributed every year. So when you get an income distribution, a lot of that can be capital gains. Whereas I believe in the US, they're more of a, in Australia, they're a pass-through entity. In the US, they're more of a, almost a close-end, not a close-end, but a there's more beneficial tax treatment in the US.
Yeah. There was a good question from Soxy earlier on, which is, can you use your super fund with member direct options? Because we spoke about that last week, to invest in Bitcoin ETFs or those types of things. So the answer is I'm not sure, because sometimes even though a stock or an ETF may be available on the stock exchange, your super fund may, or your brokerage platform, for example, may be able to not offer something. So
it depends.
Yes, the answer is it depends.
On your fund. Yeah.
Some SMSFs can use crypto. There's been some really contentious points about that over the last few years. I definitely wouldn't do it. Not to say that Bitcoin is a bad investment. Like, that's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying that I wouldn't do that with my super fund at all. And I've cue the fanatics that will now send me lots and lots of messages. But the reality is I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't do it inside super. I'd do it outside if I was going to do it. And there's more flexibility outside super anyway. And thank you, Soxy, for following along and saying, yeah, Australian super doesn't do it. And that's, Soxy, part of the reason why some brokerage platforms and super funds may stop some of us from investing in certain things is actually because they have a legal responsibility. And in the case of super, superannuation by its very creation was designed for retirement purposes. So unless they can say to their regulator, this is for a retirement purpose, they're very, very restricted in what they can do. And doesn't necessarily just mean Bitcoin in this example, could mean a lot of things, like residential property, for example. You can't buy a home, for example, if that makes sense. There was actually a really good question on that. And Marco did say you can't have more than one AFL team, but you can do all different types of investing. Well put, Marco. Love me an analogy. There was one question which came from Baron Muffett. Real name. Baron Muffett says, they say they're a financial advisor, as a financial advisor. So this is the question. If you were allowed to draw from your super to help with a deposit for your first home on the proviso that you have to put the money back in, maybe indexed, say, like it goes up until you repay it, when you sell that home, do you think this would be a good idea? And they say, as a financial advisor, I strongly believe that your home is part of your funding for your retirement, as I see many clients who downsize and have excess funds to use for retirement. I do not see the problem with it myself. It's a hot topic at the moment. Love the show, guys. Listen every week. Drew.
Oh.
This is a fiery one. And before you answer, actually, we did have Dr. Cameron Murray over on the Australian Property Podcast speaking with the wonderful, the great Pete Wargent this week. So if you do like more of this topic, Dr. Cameron Murray and Pete Wargent, who's Pete's probably a doctor of property podcasts when you think about it, you can go and check out the Australian Property Podcast. It's a wonderful podcast, airs every week. It also has its own 2 cents segment, by the way, on a Sunday morning. So Drew and I go out on a Saturday morning.
Not as good.
Yeah. Chris and Pete are not as good as Owen and Drew, but that does go out on a Sunday, which is the rest day for Drew and I. But go and check that out. So Drew, it seems like a reasonable thing. A lot of people do want to retire with a home, and it can be quite gut-wrenching when people can't do that. So should superannuation play a role in that?
I feel like this is like a philosophical question, isn't it? You know, what is the purpose of retirement? We know that having a home paid for in retirement is, you know, the most powerful things you can have. But then on the other side, and it depends as an advisor who you work with as well. That means I'm really under pressure. one of the big things is the amount of people you see that have, you know, a $3 million home, just because it's gone up so significantly. But they don't have assets, you know, enough assets or cash and cash flow to be able to fund the retirement that they want. So you've kind of got reverse issues here. I kind of see, I'm wary of indexing because essentially you're then owing yourself more and more, like a HECS debt or a HELP debt. Mm-hmm. I honestly wasn't against the idea of being able to use it for a deposit. I don't think the government was asking to index it, though. It was like a once-off, wasn't it?
Yeah, so you could withdraw it and still can first-time super saver scheme up to $60,000. So,
yeah.
FHSSS.
FHSS. So, in a long way around, I don't think it's a bad idea. there's a lot of forced saving too, and we forget, you know, essentially it's not always the case, but and this is probably even more out there.
Oh, here we go.
You know, your super guarantee in some cases is forcing you to have a lower income today for the benefit of the future. That said, property doesn't always go up. So, you know, you've got to take the negatives with the positives.
Yeah, they index it down.
I'd be wary of, you know, too many people pulling too much out of super at the same time and have to be very specific on there and what that would do to the property market. But they're all, you know, ancillary to this philosophical question.
Yeah. That's a good answer. I actually appreciate you saying that because a lot of financial advisors didn't stick their neck out and say, well, it's actually probably a pretty good thing to be able to use that when you're young. But there is the counterpoint that if you are in your 20s or 30s and you're trying to pull that money out for your first home, that's 20 or 30 years of lost compounding potentially by taking that 30, 40, whatever you take out in the end. I think this is going. What were you going to say?
I thought it was better that I didn't prepare for that question because you had to get an honest answer, not a political response.
The thing that probably is really interesting to me about this is that I think we're trying to solve a problem with something that's not a problem. So our superannuation is fine and it works wonderfully well. In fact, it's a great thing for most Australians. And we're trying to take something that's pretty bloody good and use it to solve a problem that has nothing to do with superannuation. So, yeah, I mean, sure, people's money goes into super. It's their money. It's for retirement. Sure. But at the end of the day, using that money to solve another problem, which is strictly a political problem, in my opinion, I think the housing crisis, if you want to call it that, is a strictly political problem. And the reason why it's a political problem is because there's an economic problem, which is that there aren't enough houses for the amount of people.
So the risk is when you implement a policy like this is the cost of housing just goes up by the amount.
Yeah, it will.
Super fun.
It's so dumb. All of the stupid first home schemes and all this crap. That's why I've come back to you. I've glitched maybe. But all of the crap.
Yeah, I thought you were going to drop out. You thought you were going to leave me again.
I was going to do it in the middle of a rant about property. But all of those policies, those, you know, buy under $600,000, you get lower stamp duty. That's all complete bullshit, to be honest. The only thing that's going to help is more supply of property. And the thing that needs to happen is we need more political willpower to get local councils out of the way, to get state governments out of the way, and to get more stimulus into people that build houses. Give them the ability to do that, there are things that are moving at state and government and at federal government levels, but that's the reality. So any of this other stuff that the politicians come out and say will help won't help because it's all on the demand side. It's not a demand side problem. It's a supply side. So I feel for anyone that wants to use super, and I think the first home super saver scheme is great. Could probably save a single or a couple $10,000 in tax. And it is a good strategy, but you probably do want to really understand the risks of it because you can end up with your money lost in super. Yeah, there's a lot going on. So final question for today, Drew. There are so many good questions. We did get a couple of questions through on direct stocks from Robert, your dad's brother, Fashion Phil. We will get to them. Maybe we'll get to them next week. Tricia, you did ask, how do I start the ETF course? You just do that on the Rask Education website. Check that out.
Mum's brother, yep.
Is it actually?
And my middle name, yeah.
Oh, really? Oh, g'day, Robert. So, Andrew Robert Derrimuth, here we go. This is the final question before we get to your dad joke. It's just a simple one, which is from Rachel, who says, are IPOs good to invest in as they are released, or is it better to wait until the hype settles?
I'm not going to say ID again. But it does. I mean, IPOs have been IPOs. It's a case by case basis. But IPOs, one, are quite difficult to get access to. You have to have a good relationship with brokers to get access to IPOs, and then usually the best IPOs are kind of restricted to their best, largest ongoing clients. So that's the hard part. In maybe, you know, 2 or 3 years ago, when there were heaps of IPOs and the quality was quite high, or the potential was there. But our approach generally is there's too much uncertainty, too many things you can't control. You want to look at each company case by case, but there's no need, there's no bad part of being patient when it comes to waiting for these companies to get on the ASX. They're usually, or other share markets, they're usually kind of prepped for sale and a lot of demand, a good story told, but you don't know what happens afterwards. Yes, some stag profit, some lose money, but over time they'll kind of gravitate to a fair value.
Yeah, fair enough, mate. Fair enough. I quite like that. So I want to show you something, which I'll use the Google Finance page for this for anyone that's watching. So this is the Facebook stock. This is like the share price of Facebook over time. So you can see when it IPO'd in 2012, it was around $38. I think it was $40 from memory. Maybe I'm a bit wrong on that. But then it fell to around about $19 or $18 as everyone questioned, does this thing actually make money, this Facebook thing? And it took about a year to get back to being at the IPO price. So that's the first year. Now, since then, Facebook has gone on to become a $1 trillion company. It's now nearly $500 in share price. This is a good example of when it made absolutely no sense to buy on the IPO. You could have waited. Now, the opposite could have happened, and it could have gone up in the first year. But it's worth remembering that when you buy something is not nearly as important as what you buy. And if you're buying something with a 10-year view, you're much better off just focusing on the business and less on the IPO. The IPO is all about scarcity, hype, urgency. It's all those behavioral kind of biases our mind succumbs to. Instead of all of that, just focus on the business that you're buying. And if you remember that, it wouldn't matter if it's a company that's, you know, got limited supply on the IPO. It doesn't matter if it's stag profits or drops on the first day. Who cares? What matters is that you buy it because it's a good business, and you go from there. We do have a podcast episode coming up with Nick Nicolaides, the founder or co-founder of Perla, over on the Australian Finance podcast. And he talks to us about whether or not it's worth buying a thematic ETF. And whether it's worth buying one on day one, like what actually happens and is it worth the hype? So if you're interested in that conversation, not an IPO for a share, but an IPO for an ETF, that'll be coming up soon on the Australian Finance podcast. Full disclosure, Perla is a sponsor of the Australian Finance podcast and has been for years. Okay. So Drew, if people want to get in contact with you, they can send you an email courtesy of Robert at Waddle Partners. No, just kidding. It's not Robert. It is Drew at waddlepartners.com.au.
I got three emails with some positive feedback this week, which is great.
Wonderful. That's really good. So if you do want to get in contact with Drew or the team at Waddle Partners, there is a link in the show notes, or you can use a humble email to Drew here, drew@waddlepartners.com.au. If you do look for anything else, head to the Rask websites. There's heaps of stuff down there. Lots and lots to go on. For me, you can find me on Twitter at Owen Rask. And we've got one final thing, which we always do each and every week, which is a dad joke. Oh, no, we got to pick the best question to name. There was a good question that came through live this week. And it came through, I got a mongering for the $2.99 all-you-can-eat buffet.
Book should be delivered today too.
Okay, so the golden years, how to live a good retirement. I don't know what the sub, what was the subtitle?
How to live a successful and fulfilling retirement.
How to live a successful and fulfilling retirement. The golden years is coming out in all good bookstores soon. Anyone who did have their question or question a name mentioned on the show does get a copy. You are entitled to a copy. You can send us an email at RASC. Please send us your mailing address as well. That obviously makes sense for us to send you a book when it comes out. You can find it on the website. Jeremy, I did see a question about high risk capital or something like that. We can chat about that inside RASC Core. Drew, over to you. Send us off into the sunset. What have you got for us?
This is a personal, bit personal because I've had some really good chili mussels lately. Oh, damn, I've given away. I used to search for shellfish at the beach until one day I pulled a mussel.
That makes sense because we're at the age where we do pull mussels regularly. We still think we're young enough to do something and then we pull mussels. Well, yeah, you're a bit of a specimen. Not for me though, mate. Well, this has been heaps of fun. Thank you to everyone that tuned in live, Marco, Mike, Jeremy, Benny, everyone that tuned in live. We really do appreciate you joining us. A bit ad hoc today. We're going to start doing more live shows at RASC. I know everyone loved them last year. So
8 out of 10.
Yes. 8 out of 10, is that what you got for your joke? Okay, interesting. Yeah. Thanks, Benny. Just giving him some good momentum going into the weekend. But we will be doing more live shows. I will be encouraging all of the hosts of the RASC podcast to do live shows this year on our network, which means you can head to the RASC YouTube channel. It has been growing rapidly the first few months of 2024. And in fact, Drew, you may not know this. In fact, you don't know this because only I know this because I looked at the data just before. All across all metrics, the RASC podcast network, YouTube videos, all this sort of stuff is at an all-time high. So
credit to you.
Credit to you, sir. Credit to you. Credit to everyone that plays a role in sharing these shows and what we do, our education with everyone. Over 26,000 students enrolled in our free courses, which is just humbling to say the least. So, guys, thank you for everything. Thanks for tuning in this week. Don't forget we go live every Saturday morning on the Australian Investors Podcast. Subscribe, share it with friends, leave a review, do whatever you want to do, or just rock up next week. That's good too. Drew, bye for now. I'll see you next time.
It's good to see you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast. Before you go, I wanted to share some things with you. Specifically, I wanted to tell you about the 10 ways that RASC could help you in 2024. As many of you know, RASC has grown to become one of the biggest investing and finance platforms in Australia. Across our podcasts, our websites, our memberships, and so on, we now engage around 200,000 Aussies. Which, considering we started in a humble lounge room on a Kmart desk, one of those old fake white wooden ones, I'm pretty ecstatic about where we are 6 years later. As part of becoming one of Australia's biggest platforms for wealth creation and preservation, we now have a very special position in the country in that we can bring you some of the best, most thoughtful, expert-driven ways to protect and grow your wealth. And I'm going to share some of those with you now. I've got 10 ways that we can potentially help you or match you with someone who can. The first thing that I want to tell you about is the biggest step we've ever taken at RASC, which is the launch of our RASC Invest platform. This is a platform that lets our team, led by me, invest for you, primarily through low-cost, diversified ETFs. We'll have three strategies at launch, and every investor who comes through can pick one of the three strategies, being a balanced strategy, a growth strategy, and a high growth strategy. The balanced strategy focuses on passive income, and the high growth strategy focuses on longer term compounding. You will find a link in your podcast player to register your interest. We will be taking off soon. Number two, if you prefer to DIY your investing, you can join me and over 4,000 members inside RASC Core. That's our full ETF and ASX share research membership community.
You can join now and you'll get updated ETF portfolio recommendations every quarter, as well as ongoing ASX and global stock research. Every single month, we call them the All-Star Stocks. You get that alongside the ETF portfolios, as well as other members-only content. It's called RASCore. Number three, our first ever partnership with a business other than our own was a business by the name of Blusk, which has since become Flint Group. Flint Group is led by Chris Bates and Christian Stevens, two of Australia's most highly regarded mortgage brokers. Already over 200 RASC community members have begun the RASC plus Flint Group mortgage broking process. You can click the link in your podcast player if you're refinancing, investing, a first home buyer, or whatever. You've probably heard Chris on the show many times. Number four, you can connect with our most trusted financial advisors. Whether you're 25 years old, just graduated uni and looking to set yourself up, or approaching or in retirement and you've got that nest egg you want to protect and generate a passive income from, you can get in contact with our trusted panel of financial advisors. You can find the link in your podcast player. It's there each and every week. Just click the thing that says financial planning. Number five, if you want specialist insurance advice, as Warren Buffett said, rule number one is don't lose money. And rule number two is don't forget rule number one. Insurance is vitally important, especially when it comes to your number one asset, you. Whether you're a single income household or a couple, and you just want to protect what would happen if, you want to protect your family if something goes wrong. You want to protect your spouse if you lose your job. You want to protect yourself if you hurt yourself on the weekend at footy. Insurance is a way to do that. And I think the best way to do insurance is through a financial planner. And there's a few reasons for that. But one of them is sometimes some insurers will only work with financial advisors, but they can also be your companion as you go through the sometimes daunting process of getting insurance done properly. Sometimes you might not even know, but you're not even covered, even though you think you are. So get the right advice. You'll find a link in the show notes to check that out. Number six, buying property. If you're like me and you're thinking of buying property in the next 12 months, or maybe you've already invested and you're looking to downsize, getting the right advice and being able to build wealth through property is a proven strategy. It might be one of the most contentious, but I think that we have one of Australia's best property coaches in our ranks. That is Pete Wargent. Pete is the host of the now super popular Australian Property Podcast by RASC, and he's also my analyst team's macro consultant. So if you're a member of RASCore, you will have seen Pete's name around the traps. He's a property coach and buyer's agent, and he works with a select number of people each and every year. Just a note on this, this is not a commercial thing with Pete. Pete just has great services, so we offer them to the community. And when he fills up, he fills up. You can find out more about Pete's coaching in the show notes. Next up, tracking your portfolio for tax. I think you are, because I think you have to. So we've partnered with Nivexa to help you manage your share and ETF reporting, whether it's tax or performance. All RASC users get 20% off an annual plan with Nivexa. You can sync your portfolio with Nivexa's software and it automatically tracks your dividends, your capital gains tax, and more. Again, not a commercial partnership. We don't make anything from working with Nivexa, but they do create some great tools which the RASC community uses each and every day. Number eight, want to run your own business? Maybe you already do. If you want more profit, but less stress, less time consumed, and less energy lost, get in contact. We have a partner business called Inflection. The Inflection Accelerator Program is a complete online course that helps you and a community of members engage and follow a proven strategy for growing your business. I'm grateful to be one of the coaches inside the Accelerator program, helping business owners right across Australia. You can find more following the link in your podcast player. It's the one that says coaching. Number nine, if you haven't already checked it out, join over 20,000 other people who tune into the RASC YouTube channel. It is completely free and you get notified when we go live and when we publish podcast episodes. There is a podcast on the RASC network each and every day, as well as bite-sized material that's less than 60 seconds, or those really punchy tutorials and webinars that are just 15 minutes that take you through a really exciting topic, whether it's how to buy a property, whether it's how to pick a dividend ETF. Some of our most popular content actually just explains things like, what the heck is franking credits and how do I calculate if I've got some? That's on our YouTube channel. Number 10, if you want to be a better investor, a saver, a better partner with money, or just understand your own relationship with money, you can do that, all of that, by going to the RASK Education website and taking a free course. We've enrolled over 26,000 students at the time of this recording, and we are on a mission to get to 100,000 in the next few years. RASK Education is our mostly free education platform, covering everything from budgeting and automation to the probably, I would say, the best value investing program in the country. So whether you're a value investor, an intermediate investor, you want to know how to value Woolworths shares, or you simply just want to understand what ethical investing is, or buy your first property and what actually happens on settlement day, head to the RASK Education website and enroll in something today. It is free and it supports us, because then I can come on here next month and I can say we've got 27,000. And hopefully we reach critical mass where we can help more Australians manage their money better. Thank you for listening to this long-winded ad. If you want to get in contact with me, you know where to go. There's a link in your show notes. Basically, these 10 services, even though some of them we don't make any money from, support RASK and allow us to produce these podcasts, attract the biggest and best guests from Australia and around the world, and bring them to you to answer your questions. Thank you for being part of the RASK network, and thank you for your ongoing support. Bye for now.